Hello, listeners, and welcome to a brand new episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. I am co-host Dave Kale, and I am bringing you to a very, very exciting episode that we have been anticipating for weeks now. Indeed, the very last episode, you may remember, as I'm sure you've been here live or you downloaded and listened as soon as it came out, we kept anticipating this episode, and our conversation kept bleeding into this from the topic we were supposed to be discussing. And of course, that means we'll be talking about the Attack of Smaug. That's where the previous movie left off. It's what everybody has on their brain. It's what we've all been thinking about, and it's what we expect is going to happen in the very, very early part of the film. They probably will get to it, you know, even potentially an hour in.
maybe as soon as that. Yeah.
So clearly, it's going to be the focus of the film.
Yeah.
So today we're going to be talking about Smaug's attack. And what will everybody be up to? And we have a very, very interesting riddle to pose that I actually expect people won't anticipate. I think you'll be surprised by this riddle. So without further ado, let's get started. Let me introduce to you the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, and the smart and ever hardworking and absolutely essential, the only reason this show happens the way it does, Trish Lambert, my wonderful co-host.
Could be good or bad. But hello, everybody.
it did sound potentially like a qualification there, yes, no, absolutely. As Tolkien would say, meaning nothing but good.
The only reason the show has any kind of structure or organization.
Exactly. Well, we have.
She can only hold back the tide barely.
Right. Yes, true. It's true. Yeah. Sometimes
it's
great difficulty.
Evidenced by the half-hour late start due to discussion of various and sundry unrelated topics.
Yes. Yeah, I'll tell you, boy, I knew this a long time ago. I mean, if I was really, like, oriented around, you know, must start at a certain time, or must do this, must do that, I'd be dead by now, because it's what it does. I mean, I'd be like, or you guys would have to have fired me, because I would have been, like, impossible to work with.
Yeah, we still have to get that orc whip sound for you, Trish.
Well, actually, Corey, I did, actually. And in the last recording of last episode, I inserted the whip crack at the right points.
Awesome.
Yes. Along with the Batman thing that Dave provided.
Oh, good.
Yeah, sweet. So the recorded episode is actually fun to listen to, because there are whip cracks and the Batman.
Very good. Very good. Amazing. Very appropriate. All right, very good. Well, I've got two announcements to start with. The first thing I wanted to announce is a new partnership. This is a fun opportunity. I have been having conversations with the chairman of the UK Tolkien Society, Sean Gunner. And we have established an official partnership between the Tolkien Society and Mythgard. So, and the way it works is very simple. Anyone who is a member, is actually a registered and paying member of the Tolkien Society, not automatically. You have to actually put a code in for it, but gets a 15% discount on auditing Mythgard classes. So if you are a member of the Tolkien Society, you'd be very welcome to come, and you get a discount at Mythgard classes. I would also recommend those of you who take Mythgard classes and are not members of the Tolkien Society might want to think about it, because you can get the discount that way as well. The Tolkien Society is really great. For those of you who are not familiar with it, they're the longest standing society of their kind, but they're doing some really exciting things. They just completely revamped their website, for instance, which is now awesome. It used to be okay, but it was kind of 1993. It's now a really good website, and they've got lots of really cool things and resources. So I definitely recommend that you look into them, we are looking forward to partnering with the Tolkien Society in various ways. We may be working with them at some of their conferences and our conferences. We might be working together on some of our events in the future. We've been talking about the possibility of arranging a lecture series and various other things. So there should be a lot of fun stuff with Mythgard and the Tolkien Society working together. So that's one thing that has recently come about that I wanted to share with people. Is it's a lot of fun. It's something I've been excited about. The other thing that I wanted to mention is we are doing another, Laura Burkholz and I are doing another episode of Riddles in the Dark Supererogatory. So our new spin-off Above and Beyond the Call of Duty Riddles in the Dark show, a supplemental show. We're going to be doing, we're going to be recording that one live on this coming Monday. So Monday at the same time, 10 a.m. Eastern time, on this coming Monday, April, what is that? 7th? Yes. 7th. Monday, yep. April 7th at 10 a.m. Eastern time. We'll be recording our next Riddles in the Dark Supererogatory. And
you guys are repeating 3.02, right? Should I mention that part?
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay, so there was an interesting those any of you who attended that show live may recall that I had a some kind of really weird hardware issue in the middle of that episode. And I ended up having to do some on-the-fly hardware extemporizing in order to finish the episode. Apparently, my hardware extemporizing totally threw off my recording program, so the recording got messed up at that. But the recording up to that point, which was about more than two-thirds of the episode, was fine. So we got that, and you know, we're able to release that. But we are going to have to redo the last bit of it. So we'll so we will be going over some ground that we did at the end of that episode, and then we'll move forward to other things. Also, we have a special guest this time. The special guest won't be joining us on Monday morning. She couldn't make it for that time slot. So I have met with her at a different time and recorded an interview with her. This is with Professor Robin Reed, who is a Tolkien scholar who specializes in cultural studies, 20th century cultural studies. So rather than focusing, as so many Tolkien scholars like me do, on the medieval stuff in Tolkien, she focuses on Tolkien's relationship with his with 20th century society, basically looking both at the cultural impact of 20th century factors on Tolkien, as well as looking at Tolkien's impact on 20th century society. So she's going to be teaching a class on that in Mythgard this summer, and I had a discussion with her. She is currently publishing stuff on Peter Jackson's Hobbit films. She's doing a really interesting article on Toriel, actually, right now. So we talked some about that. We talked, you know, I had her explain more about what she does, you know, what it means to study Tolkien from a, you know, from a cultural studies and audience reception standpoint, you know, which is the kind of work that she does. And so that should be really fun. That will be included in the published episode of Riddles in the Dark Supererogatory number 2. But then we will also include with that the recording we do on Monday. So I invite you all to join me on Monday if you can. So I wanted to make sure to mention that was happening. And that's the end of our early announcements. We will have more at the end to do a teaser of our teaser announcement. Several of you have been asking about Mythmoot. We will do some Mythmoot announcing at the end of the episode. But I wanted to talk. I wanted to start off today because we were talking about the death of Smaug, and I wanted to start off as we are wont to do by talking about the book and the way that the death of Smaug is treated in the book, and some of the things which I think are really important factors of the way Tolkien treats this in the book, and then thinking about to what extent the film is going to be interacting with those. One of the main things that we get, of course, you know, one of the things to keep in mind, and it's one of the things that makes the adaptation, I think, of this part of the Hobbit story. By this part, I really mean pretty much from chapter 10 on, from the arrival in the Lonely Mountain, in Lake Town on. one of the things that really makes it challenging is that so much of this stuff was semi-spontaneous when Tolkien wrote it. Just, you know, this part is just packed with things that he didn't really anticipate and that he didn't really have a plan for. You know, when they arrived in Lake Town, Tolkien had no idea. You know, Bard didn't exist as a character. He was not conceived. He was conceived by Tolkien just as the dragon is attacking. You know, at the beginning of chapter 14, that's when Bard appears. He shows up just in time to kill the dragon, and in the first episode, died. It's one of my favorite revisions. If I had to choose, of all of the revisions Tolkien did of his earlier work, what is my favorite single change that he made? It may be this, actually. In his first manuscript, the first manuscript broke off right after the death of the dragon. He stopped there for a while and then came back to it later on. There was a gap in time there. And the end of the first manuscript, it says, "And that was the end of the dragon and of Esgaroth and of Bard." Because Bard died in the original version. And then when he goes back to pick it, so then time passes and he goes back to complete the story, and he just wrote above the line, "And not of Bard." You know, he just inserted a "not" and had Bard survive. So with the addition of that one word, you know, he reinserted the character of Bard, and that's, you know, where then we get the whole thing with Bard leading the army and the Arkenstone and everything else. What I was saying about the challenges for adaptation, many of these things, as I said, were not envisioned by Tolkien at the time. He didn't know how the dragon was going to die. He didn't know what was going to become of Bard's character. He didn't even know he was going to happen, and then when he did happen, he killed him off and then changed his mind about that. If you're doing an adaptation of this, you can't exactly replicate that, or rather it would be weird to. The way it happens in the book, because of the accidents of Tolkien's composition process, Bard comes out of nowhere. You know, he has no background, you know, no clear background, no personal background. He has no setup in the story. He's not a factor in the politics of Lake Town. All of those questions that we were asking about, you know, sort of the balance of power in Lake Town and what exactly is sort of the climate in Lake Town, and the whole question of how do you deal with, you know, having an elected master of Lake Town, how do you deal with having an elected master of a town in which it is known that the heir of the kingdom that was is still living, you know, is still residing? How do you handle that? Well, Tolkien never had to answer that question because, that wasn't in his mind at the time. You know, so when he wrote chapter 10, Bard didn't exist. So Bard was a non-factor in the build-up to the dwarves' departure for the Lonely Mountain with the help of the Master. When you're doing the film, though, it seems to me, a level of adherence to the book, which would be simply silly, to say, oh, you know, yeah, let's give him no backstory. Let's not integrate him. You know, we've just been in Lake Town. Let's omit Bard from that scene because Tolkien omitted him. Well, Tolkien only omitted him because he hadn't thought of him yet when he wrote that. I strongly suspect, had Tolkien completed his thoroughgoing revision of The Hobbit, which he began in 1960, which, of course, I've said many times I'm grateful he didn't, because it's not very good, but if he had completed it, I would be shocked if he had not written Bard back into chapter 10. I feel very confident he would have done that, given the kind of stature that he gave to Bard's character and the kind of role that Bard in his line ends up playing in the future history of Middle-earth, you know, in the Lord of the Rings to come. So here's Peter Jackson. Here are the adapters with this challenge of taking a character who only comes in late in the game in the book, but trying to deal with him from the beginning. And it's a kind of challenge, I think, that they deal with a lot in adapting The Hobbit. But in thinking of the death of the dragon, you have the sudden appearance of Bard. One of the things that I emphasized in my book, one of the things that I'm most interested in is the way in which I love the title of this chapter. It's one of my very favorite chapter titles in The Hobbit, Fire and Water. The way in which the struggle is, through that title and through some of the descriptions, especially of Smaug's actual fall into the lake, but even the line I'm particularly remembering is the one where it's, you know, where Tolkien says that you know, Smaug, he couldn't fight against the lake, you know, the lake would beat him, the lake was too much for him. This is why the destruction of the bridge was such a big deal, because the bridge was strong enough, the bridge back to the mainland was strong enough that it could have held Smaug, so he could have landed on it, and therefore been much more at his ease to go through and pick apart Lake Town and kill the people, instead of just doing flybys, which is all he's stuck with since he can't land once they take the bridges down. That's why they cut the bridges as soon as Smaug shows up. But he doesn't dare now to try to land on the town, lest he, you know, lest he fall into the water and be drowned and the water destroy him. So again, it's the way in which the book sets this up, as on the one hand, you have Smaug as this apparently unconquerable force. You know, I mean, how can this town possibly stand up, you know, to Smaug the almost invincible? And we see him, you know, enjoying himself as he is, you know, disregarding the warriors of the town and enjoying the sport of town baiting more than he's enjoyed anything for a long time. And then, but nevertheless, at the same time as we're getting these images of Smaug being being invulnerable and the town, you know, not able at all to stand up against him, there's also this larger context. The lake itself provides this larger context, this sort of reminder, you know, at the end of the day, actually, Smaug is not of the kind of force of nature that he believes himself to be. You know, when you put him in a bigger context, you put him up against, you know, not the men of Lake Town, but the lake itself. You know, when you have fire versus water, that's actually not a fair fight. It's as unfair a fight in the other direction as Smaug versus the town is. So I love the way in which the title of the chapter invites us to look at the whole fight in a different way. Again, if we're just following the action, it looks like the destruction of Lake Town is completely inevitable. You know, we have that sense. It's my favorite element of the end of The Desolation of Smaug, that look on Bilbo's face when he's watching Smaug go and saying, "What have we done?" It's clear. I mean, it seems to me clear in Bilbo's face right there that he sees, you know, they have no hope. He's just going to he's going to rip that town completely apart. Smaug is just going off to kill everybody, and there's nothing they can do about it. And yet, we're given this wider context. In the end, this is a battle between fire and water, and we know who wins the fight between fire and water. So his death is in this way inescapable. The other element that I think along those lines is this is another place where we see that element of prophecy, that element of destiny come into play very strongly in the published Hobbit, through the figure of destiny that Bard becomes, the lost heir of Girion, who here emerges unexpectedly, certainly unexpectedly to the reader, unexpectedly to Tolkien in Lake Town. You know, so we have this story coming to this fairy tale fruition, you know, of the lost heir coming back and slaying the dragon. You know, we have the mythic element of the Black Arrow, you know, and Bard's, you know, invocation of the Black Arrow there as he shoots it. And then, of course, you have the Thrush, the almost divine intervention element of it, this magical moment, literally magical moment, when this magical thrush perches on his shoulder and speaks to him, and he finds he can understand what the thrush is saying because he is of the blood of Girion. And the thrush itself, of course, with the role that the thrush has played as the sign of the fulfillment of you know, the prophecy of the secret door that's written in the on the map, you know, the role of the thrush back in chapter 11. at the opening of the door, you know, it's you know, he's like the herald of, you know, seems to be a sort of a spokesperson, a sort of a representative of the, you know, of destiny, of the magical sort of at least supernatural power that seems to be at work in the opening of the gate. And then that, you know, so then that thrush is now Bard's guide and shows up to Bard. So that, you know, that element, the way in which Tolkien chooses to make, you know, the way in which he makes sure that the death of the dragon is a really significant moment, not just an exciting moment, you know, not just a dramatic high point in the book, but a really mythic moment. You know, the death of the dragon is really important, and not just for, you know, sort of simple plot-based reasons, but thematically, as I say, mythically important. So that then leads to the question: to what extent do we expect these elements to come out in the film? What elements would you expect the film to emphasize? How would you expect the death of the dragon to be treated? Is it going to have this kind of a mythic impact? Or is it just going to be, you know, do we expect to see sort of in the end just another action sequence? How do we think we might, since this is one of the games that we enjoy playing in Riddles in the Dark, if we were doing this, how would we try to do it? You know, what are the ways in which we think the kind of mythic significance of the death of the dragon could be conveyed? What would they have to do on screen to keep it from just being another action sequence? Do you guys have any ideas about this?
We know it's going to be special effects laden, for sure.
Yeah. Yes, it will.
Do we think they're even concerned about this?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is explicitly a question they've asked themselves. But I don't care if they have. To some extent, I actually think it might be something. It's conceivable that they've asked themselves this question. It's conceivable that this issue is a factor in their thinking, whether they're consciously articulating it in this way or not. Obviously, the death of the dragon needs to be a big deal. And I would think that anybody would have the sense that there needs to be more weight to it. You know, there needs to be a bigger sort of payoff, you know, at the very least emotional payoff.
Right.
If not, you know, but more, you know, dramatic payoff. Again, they might not use the word mythic, but there's got to be more there than, say, you know, the barrel ride sequence. Like, it's obviously got to be, it doesn't need to be longer, necessarily. The barrel ride sequence was long enough, but it needs to feel weightier. Clearly, it needs to feel weightier. So how do you do that? How do you go about, again, you're designing the film, how do you go about, you know, making this not just, and now another special effects action sequence?
Sharon Hoff suggested that the mythic part may come after the death in the resolution of regaining order in Lake Town, you know, with Bard's taking back the role, you know, his role as king and whatnot.
Yes.
I mean, I could see that, because I wonder, like Dave said, did they even think about it? I mean, I could just see Jackson, you know, the little boy in Jackson going, oh, we'll have great special effects during the dragon's death, and not even think in terms of any kind of mythic. You know, I mean, I think the whole water fire thing would be awesome if that showed up in the sequence. Also, the bridge. You know, I mean, we know there's a bridge because we saw Legolas go. Is that going to feature? Are we going to see that bridge get destroyed, or the fact that Smaug could walk on it if he chose to? I don't know.
I would go with yes there. The one thing that's a little bit unclear to me is this. Gale, you know, since we saw, you know, we did see Legolas galloping away over the bridge, and thinking of that shot, it wasn't really obvious. I can't remember precisely the scale, if Smaug would be able to fit on it. I mean, if that's even going to be a relevant question,
right,
based on the scale of Smaug that they've introduced into the film. I like to think, I mean, that's what I was thinking when we got that shot near the end of the film of Legolas galloping away over the bridge. I was like, ooh, the bridge, it's a setup. It's a setup for the dragon fight. They've shown the bridge, so now they can cut it down and we'll know what it looks like. But I don't know. I mean, again, if it's too small for the jumbo sized, the, I think appropriately jumbo sized Smaug that we get, in the movie, they might not bother with it.
I could see Smaug trying to land on it and breaking it that way.
Right. Or even Smaug deliberately taking it out.
Right.
You know, if they don't throw it down to prevent him landing on it, I could see him, destroying it on purpose to try to trap everybody.
Right.
But,
not very mythic.
Going back to Sharon's point, I do agree. Sharon, I think you're right that one way that they can have a really significant impact, they can give it a significant impact, is in retrospect. That is, they can grant a mythic weight to the death of the dragon if it is by that act that Bard basically, you know, rises to kingly stature.
And redeems his family line.
And redeems
his
family line, yes.
The crack that the master made.
Absolutely, absolutely. So,
yeah, it seems like they've kind of started setting up some of these things with that line and with the emphasis on him figuring out deciphering the old mm-hmm. you know the
yes.
old
prophecy
riddle or poem or prophecy. Yeah, so it seems like they're at least setting up some potential, planting some potential seeds that point in this direction.
I agree. I mean, I think that that's something certainly that could work. I mean, I definitely agree that there's a lot of emotional impact that it could be given. I mean, this is one thing I think that is easy. You know, we spend a lot of time emphasizing the parts that are harder to do in a visual medium than in a written medium. You know, when we're talking about the adaptation and, oh, it's going to be really hard to do that on film, it's going to be really hard to do that on film. Well, you know, one thing that's easier to do on film is shots of people terrified and suffering. That's easier to do on film. Effectively to convey the terror of the people and the grieving of the people whose homes are being destroyed and whose family members are being killed. And, the panic of the people as the wooden town on the lake starts to burn around them. That's something that is much harder to convey powerfully and effectively in prose than it is on screen. So in that way, the destruction of Lake Town could feel much more emotionally powerful in the moment. Then Tolkien, with his narrator, he does a really good job of coming back and drawing our attention to it. It's another thing that I emphasized in my book, that he goes really kind of out of his way to tell us things that we didn't absolutely have to know in order to move forward, about how, you know, a quarter of the people of Lake Town died, and another quarter of them are going to die over the winter that's coming and everything else. So it's not that Tolkien doesn't go there. It's not that Tolkien doesn't give us that. But he doesn't give us much of that in the moment. Because, as I say, it's much harder to do. He would have to pause in the action sequence for a long time in order to convey that. And you can do that, I think, very efficiently on film. So I would expect that kind of thing. That's not the same thing as mythic impact, but certainly by showing the trauma of the people of Lake Town in that moment, these varying different kinds of trauma that they will be experiencing when this happens, he can certainly make it feel like not just another barrel chase. I mean, that's certainly one easy way to make it not like just any other action sequence.
Right. You know, Kate Neville makes an interesting point. Will Feely assume that Thorin is dead and that he is now king? It's a really good question.
Yeah.
He could end up taking quite a role in the fight in Lake Town if that's the case.
That's a fascinating point, Kate. I had never thought of that. Because, of course, everybody does assume Thorin is dead. Everybody assumes. The Elven King assumes it. The Master assumes it. Everyone's like, well, that's the last they've heard of Thorin. And so I remember everyone is shocked when they show up at the mountain and Thorin's there.
Feely's going to be pissed when he gets to Erebor. Right. Damn, he's alive.
I'm not king anymore. I was briefly an erroneously king. But yeah, no, Kate, you're absolutely right. And then, you know, especially then with the big deal, with the fact that the entire audience was reminded or perhaps informed that Feely was Thorin's heir, you know, when he set off there in film two, that's a really great point. Because, yeah, everyone's going to assume that. So then how does that enter into, you know, the following sequences? Does he believe that he is therefore the king and thus the representative of, you know, right. the interests of Erebor there in the town afterwards? That's
also changes. We haven't gotten to it yet, but, you know, we should keep this question in mind for the siege part of yes. episodes as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's now, an angle
also,
on those that I hadn't
of
thought
course,
of.
If Feely survives the Lake Town and the Smaug's attack, which is another question.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah. Do any of them die is definitely another question.
Oh, my God, Michael Lucero just gave a cue to one of the cartoons I sent you.
Oh, yeah?
They could have Smaug sink into the water, then hint that he will emerge again like he did from the molten gold, but then have his glowing chest seem to burn out and grow cold from the water quenching it, and have him finally lapse back into the lake.
There you go. Michael's got the whole thing envisioned. Right, yeah, yeah. He's yes. got the he's got the whole thing... the whole thing sorted out. Yeah, it's interesting. I can see some. I wonder. I mean, we saw him sort of him Smaug shaking off the gold. You know, with which he was coated there. But I wonder to what extent. You know, or if to any extent that gold is going to come up again in this way, is it going to be a visual feature during the fight or during the, you know, are we going to get glints of gold coming up from the water? That would be really interesting. Yeah.
Huh.
All right, here's the Death of Smaug.
This is a drawing by a man by the name of Graham Skinner, who's a Tolkien Society member, and I ran across this yesterday, and I don't know, it just made me kind of chuckle. I mean, the only thing is, there should be air bubbles coming out of his mouth, you know, but he's sinking to the bottom of the lake here.
Even just, you know, the idea of just sort of seeing Smaug suspended, just like the idea of him sinking, again, just sort of to show, even though he's huge, he's really small compared to the lake.
And look at the itty-bitty arrow!
Yes. Yes. Which, see, it's exactly, when you try to depict it, doesn't it look, I mean, you see it, a realistically sized arrow sticking out of the dragon, and I don't know about you, but my thought is like, there's no way that could be fatal.
Actually, he's made that even bigger than I think an arrow would be. Yeah, that's probably more the size of the arrow they're using in the movie.
Maybe, but yeah. Yeah, it's, Yeah. I'll do the other one too.
Yeah. This is many years later. And there's a quote that goes with this, right, Corey?
Oh, yes. This is, you know, when, because there's a diver finding the black arrow, you know, is that Bard's reference to, you know, never have you failed me and always have I recovered you. It's like, yeah, this is the recovery of the black arrow. The black arrow continues its streak, though of course the book explicitly says this doesn't happen, right? That nobody ever dared to dive down to recover
right.
the gems and everything from Smaug's carcass. But yeah. Anyway, okay. So but with the other thing that I wanted to talk about is the thrush. First the question of the specific thrush. Do you guys think we're going to get the thrush at all? Like, will any thrushes be spotted during the film? I'm operating under the assumption that we are going to be getting no thrush conversation. No thrush will perch on Bard's shoulder
right.
in film three. That seems
highly
pretty
unlikely.
Pretty clear. The thrush that we've seen in both films so far seems to be a perfectly natural and ordinary thrush.
and also, significantly, does not seem to have overheard anything of importance. So even if this thrush did land on Bard's shoulder, it doesn't seem like it would have anything substantive to tell him.
He'd probably just poop on his shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's... it seems to me... beyond unlikely, it seems almost impossible that they could do anything close to approximating the actual thrush scene. But
that doesn't mean we're not going to get a thrush. We still could get the
thrush. We still could get a cameo. We still could get the thrush Easter egg.
Thrush walking through, picking at insects as they fight in Lake Town.
That's right. Yeah, but, exactly.
Well, let's step back a moment. How on earth is... He already knows about the Lucent scale.
Yeah.
He?
Right.
Yeah. Bane talked about it in the second film.
Well, and Garion shoved it loose when he missed with the arrow, right?
Exactly.
That's the story. Yeah.
And Bane speaks of that. See, this is the thing that's fascinating to me. If you're going to take out the thrush, I would go back as a point of contrast. I'm going to do what Dave always loves it when I do. That is, go back to the Rankin Bass film.
Yeah. Great.
Think about how any opportunity Dave can have to think about the Rankin Bass film is a good thing. In the Rankin Bass film, there are two factors that I would point out. First, the thrush not only plays his role, but has an increased role. For those of you who remember the cartoon Rankin Bass film, the thrush not only goes and tells Bard about the missing scale. The thrush accompanies Bilbo down into the mountain.
Oh, that's right.
To confront Smaug in his lair. So there's this wonderful sense in which, remember, in the book, it's a big deal about how Bilbo goes on. He's alone, right? Balin goes down with him part of the way, but then Bilbo, has to go and moving forward from there is the bravest thing he's ever done in his life. And, everything else that happened later is as
an adventure. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, please. That was so uncalled for, I can't even tell you. One of my least favorite moments in the Rankin Bass film. But the point is, in the Rankin Bass film, he's not alone. The thrush is with him, right? And he actually seems to get some, moral support from the thrush down there. So the thrush's role is increased. And his role as messenger, sort of quasi-supernatural messenger, at least talk in the sense of talking bird, messenger to Bard is intact. However, and this is to me the interesting thing, the Rankin-Bass film makes the choice to demystify, to de-supernaturalize the opening of the door. The falling of the ray of light upon the keyhole with the last light of the setting sun of Durin's day is done through a Stonehenge kind of device, right? The rock that's there has a hole in it, and it's set up to be a purely astronomical thing. Again, it's like a little mini dwarven Stonehenge. On that particular day, the sun is at the right angle to shine through this little hole that has been bored in the rock, so as to illuminate the keyhole. It's made into a totally mechanical process, presumably designed by the dwarves. The way in which in the book it's a very mystical moment. I mean, it's the moment when destiny happens. That moment is suppressed. So you have the suppression of the supernatural element of the story in the Rankin Bass. And yet, not only the retention, but the escalation of the thrush's role. Now, in the Peter Jackson film, we have had from the beginning not the suppression, but the escalation of the supernatural element. This is one of the things that surprised me early on in An Unexpected Journey, was when they're at the unexpected party, they're at Bag End, and Owen makes his speech about the omens, right? He's like the all the signs are pointing to, and he talks to it, speaks of a prophecy which doesn't exist in the book, right? About the birds are returning, and that shows that the dragon will be killed. So he talks about prophecies are being fulfilled, signs have been given, omens have been perceived that point towards the destined fall of the dragon. The role of fate in the story is emphasized by Elrond at Rivendell. Again, this is in the Unexpected Journey. This is in the Peter Jackson version. I was really impressed, especially there in film one, with the extent to which not only were they not shying away and trying to make it much more naturalistic, again, like the Rankin-Bass film did, they were not following in those footsteps, but instead making it more supernatural. And yet, no Thrush. We don't get despite that fact. So we have these two film versions moving in polar opposite directions on both of those questions, the use of the Thrush and the presence of supernatural elements. So I think about the Peter Jackson film, and what do we see instead? Well, we do get something in place of the Thrush. What we get in place of the Thrush is legend, is tradition, right? Bayon already delivered the message. Bard doesn't need it, right? He knows that Smaug has a loose scale. How does he know? Because it's been handed down from their fathers, right? In fact, it's like a sort of mythic stature of Bard's, of his lineage, of his role as heir of the king. Like, you know, if he's going to assume his kingdom, if he's going to come into his own and fulfill his destiny as, you know, like his line being the once and future kings, you know, of Dale and the Lake. If the death of the dragon is what's going to bring that about, what makes the death of the dragon possible is also part of that. To make the loosening of his scale not just a random fact discovered by Bilbo. We never know in the book, of course, why Smaug is missing a scale there. No rationale for that is ever given. He just happens not to have it, and Bilbo sees it. Whereas here now, the loosening of the scale and the final destruction of the dragon are made continuous. That entire thing is kind of given over to the line of Girion. So I think it's not being completely demystified by this. Again, it's not de-supernaturalizing movement on the part of the Peter Jackson films, but rather it places that mystique entirely in the mythic position of the lost heir of the kingship. That's why I was very interested in Sharon mentioning that as a way in which they could build up, the epic status of the death of the dragon, because it seems to me like they're already moving in that direction.
Well, now, with the Thrush topic, I mean, the one thing that I do think of is the fact that we have had the Thrush, a Thrush, in every one of the movies. Now, it's been very Thrushy. I mean, it's been a bird. It's been doing things that birds do.
Yes.
So I've been trying to think, gee, on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, surely the Thrush will show up again in movie three. But if it's going to still act like a bird, what on earth could it be doing? You know, right. I suggested to Corey that it could be dive-bombing Smaug, which would probably last all of a fraction of a second before it gets incinerated. I suppose it could turn into, you know, Gandalf's deliverance from Dol Guldur. We could switch him completely over and he could be in lieu of the moth. So, I mean, on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, gosh, we've had it too. And also the Thrush did figure into those prophecies that Owen reported at the United States Party. So I'm thinking we're going to see him, but I just don't know in what capacity.
Right. See, that's a really good point, is that in the extra omens and prophecies that have been inserted by, in the Peter Jackson films, the Thrush already featured in that. So in fact, even just by acting thrushy, as you say, I love that adjective, or let's make it an adverb, by acting thrushily, he's already been an instrument, or, you know, been an agent, right, anyway, of the fulfillment of prophecy. His very return, and especially with the focus that is placed on it by having it be the final sequence in film one. Owen has returned to has emphasized the significance of birds returning to the mountain and as portending the death of Smaug. And the last thing that we see at the end of film one is the Thrush returning to the mountain and starting to beat his snails against the rock and
moving at the speed of light.
Exactly. Well, of course everybody does. Who doesn't? but, uh,
And then the Dragon's Eye opening, which gives the opening of the Dragon's Eye at the end of the first film such a delightfully ambivalent status, right? Because on the one hand, it's ominous, it's a threat. You know, the dragon is awakening and danger is awaiting for you. But at the same time, Smaug's own death sentence has already been passed. You know, it's already been pointed to by the thrush that's knocking on the snail upstairs. So the thrush has already played a role in that. He's done. He can retire. He's done enough, this thrush. You know, he's how many times does one single thrush have to be an instrument of the fulfillment of prophecy after all?
This is such a derailment, but I remember a cartoon a few years ago in one of the animation events about a baby dragon making friends with a bird, and he gets so excited that he incinerates the bird.
That's horrible.
Terrible. Talk about black humor. It was really terrible. It's like at the ear, oh, it's in a cute, he's such a cute little dragon. You're like, oh. Anyway. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, now, you know, we also have the Roach conversation, but we'll save that for...
Yeah, that's Maribor a different question. But yeah, that's... I'm still... So I'm giving up on the thrush. I think that there is a less than 1% chance we will see a thrush perched on Bard's shoulder. I just... I do not in any way think that that's going to happen. But I am not giving up on Roach.
Anybody who attends Riddles in the Dark Supererogatory for this episode, remind Corey that this could be a good conundrum. Will a thrush appear?
Will a thrush appear? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I am not giving up on Roach, though. I refuse to give up on Roach.
Well, I think who was it? Our one of our visitors from Australia said. I guess on April Fool's Day, I guess it was the One Ring announced that Luke Evans announced that he was going to be the voice of Roach in movie 3. So we're not sure if it was an April Fool's joke or not. Probably was.
It's a pretty subtle April Fool's joke.
At the same time, they also announced that the release date for the film was being pushed back to July 2015.
Oh, that is just rude.
See, that's more what I would expect from an April Fool's joke, you know.
Yeah, so I didn't buy anything they said that day.
Yeah, yeah, of course, that's always a good policy. Yeah, well...
I thought the Orlando Bloom getting a star on the Walk of Fame was an April Fool's joke.
You mean until you saw pictures of it?
Yeah, until the next day they actually were showing that it happened.
Right.
Terrible.
Yeah. That is embarrassing. If I were his agent, I would be ticked. That they, you know, announced that on April Fool's Day.
On April Fool's. I know.
I mean, how humiliating to have, like, an announcement of what should be, like, a culmination of your career and everybody thinks you're joking. And everybody assumes it must be a gag.
Everybody's going, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, exactly. That's
yeah, they'll never put Orlando Bloom on there. Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
Now, Michael Lucero reminds us that we also have Mr. Radagast, who talks to birds, you know, which is another possibility that we could see the thrush
maybe
showing.
Maybe Radagast will be perched on Bard's shoulder?
Well, that's a really disturbing
image. It's a different, you know, the thrush could come tell Radagast that there's doings in Lake Town or something, you know, that the dragon's attacked. I don't know. My brain is now sprained.
Yeah, no, I don't think we're gonna get. I don't think anyone is gonna act particularly thrushily in film 3. Thrushily is my word of the day now. By the way, I'm gonna see how many times I can use the word, the adverb thrushily.
That'd probably get you a pretty good score.
Wouldn't it though? That would be an awesome Scrabble word. I'm telling you, at least with the modified rules. But anyway, So I. But again, what I would want to emphasize is that I do think, you know, it's this is one of the things. It's actually a kind of interesting case study for one of my, you know, oft repeated exhortations concerning the film. It is really easy to look at something like this and say, oh, see, they screwed it up because they took out the thrush. I mean, assuming that the thrush, in fact, does not land on his shoulder, I'm going to go ahead and assume that that's not going to happen. If that doesn't happen, it's really easy to sort of take a relatively simple-minded purist route and say, see, the thrush was supposed to tell him, and the thrush, so he took out the thrush, and that's awful, and so, you know, like, it's obviously really bad because the thrush isn't there. But in doing that, if all you're doing is looking for things that are in the book and getting upset when they're absent, what you're not doing is thinking about and paying attention to what is there. And I actually think that that choice, the choice to place, to shift the mythic emphasis from that kind of a eucatastrophic intervention, which it is, I'm not criticizing how it happens in the book. It's really powerful in the book. But to shift that to the emphasis that they're placing on the tradition of Girion and the status that they're giving into Girion's final stand. We don't know in the book how Girion dies. We know that Smaug kills him, but we have no idea if his, you know, so now the film is investing the death of Girion with some significance. He died, but he didn't wholly die in vain. And remember, that's what Baen is holding on to. That scene, which I quite liked, when Baen retells the story, you know, like, no, Girion didn't miss. He accomplished something. And, you know, it has been a truth that has been, cherished by the heirs of Girion since, that Girion accomplished something, and that now Smaug has a weak spot thanks to Girion, and the heir of Girion can exploit that and recover the honor of his house and his kingdom in one blow. There is a very different kind of mythic power. It's a different myth, but there's still mythic power in that. And so again, you know, it's I can mourn the thrush. You know, I like the thrush. I'm quite attached to how the story unfolds in the book, but at the same time, I can appreciate, you know, the elevation of the line of Girion, and the way in which they have chosen to take the significance of the line of Girion and expand it and work it backwards more deeply into the fabric of the story from the beginning, rather than have it come in at the end as not quite an afterthought, but a last-minute thought on Tolkien's part. I think that's a really interesting idea. I think that works really well and has the potential to be really cool.
Oh, it's going to be, that's building a lot of pressure, because, I mean, I can imagine developing the scene, you know, in terms of bards, you know, there's more writing on this than just killing the dragon, and one would expect him to be mindful of that even, you know, even in the midst of trying to, you know, avert the immediate disaster. I mean, it's a pretty big deal.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 So I think it's definitely not something that has merely been removed and not replaced with anything. Nor, as I say, nor do I think that this is a question of them stripping it of myth, you know, stripping the story of mythic significance or anything like that. It's a shift. They're placing the emphasis, the power of it somewhere else. And I think in the context, it's a really interesting, and it certainly is in keeping with the story that they've been telling. You know, now we have, and through this element of the story, increasingly we have Thorin as, or Bard as a queer foil to Thorin. You know, more emphasis has been placed from the beginning, in a way which seems to me entirely appropriate, on Thorin's, you know, on the whole Return of the King story with Thorin. Well, we're getting the return of two different kings here now. You know, now we're having Bard's story, and the fact, you know, this sort of reminder, hey, you know, yeah, the dwarves have been, you know, they experienced this, you know, this Holocaust in Diaspora, you know, when Smaug attacked, and that's really serious, and that's a big deal, and so it means a lot to Thorin to both take vengeance for that and to, you know, to undo that. But you know what? The same thing has happened in Laketown.
Right.
The same thing happened with Bard and his people. And we can forget that. So, yeah, yeah. I think, Timothy, you make a great point. Timothy says,
the thrush in Tolkien is fairy tale. The Girion story is epic. I agree. And that seems to me entirely, you know, Timothy, as you're suggesting, entirely in keeping with the kind of shift that we're getting. Fairy tale is exactly, that's the world the Hobbit lives in. It's a fairy tale world. It's not an epic world in the same way that The Lord of the Rings is living much more in an epic world than in a fairy tale world. And in bringing the Hobbit story into contact with that larger story, Peter Jackson, you know, is definitely bringing it into that more of an epic register. And Timothy, I think I agree with you. I think it's a really good way to think about it. There are ways in which some of the more fairy tale elements would seem bizarrely out of place in the kind of story that Peter Jackson is telling, because he's telling a story which is more like the Lord of the Rings register than the Hobbit register. Deliberately.
Well, and, you know, a note from Kate, too, same thing. You know, taking away the talking animals is under that same thing. You know, it's de-fairy-tailing, mm-hmm. or as Timothy says, epifying the tale as opposed to keeping the fairy tale. And I agree with that. I think that's true. I think that's probably something we can kind of use as a yardstick, mm-hmm. is that Jackson is working on this being an epic and taking away any kind of fairy tale elements. Of course, we're almost at the point of the story where they're gone anyway.
Yeah, there aren't that many left. Exactly, right. Yeah, because certainly the battle, once we get to the battle, to the siege of the Lonely Mountain and the Battle of Five Armies to follow, the Hobbit itself, you're right, does cease to be fairy tale-ish. In fact, you could almost say the thrush is like the end. I mean, it's like the last fairy tale element in the Hobbit. I mean, I'm trying to think of other, I mean, of course, we revisit some of
Beorn,
them.
Beorn, I suppose, but if you consider a shapeshifter still a fairy tale element.
Well,
suppose,
no,
Beorn,
but no, no, I wouldn't. I mean,
the way he's used in, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Not then. Maybe when they met him, but not in the battle. In the battle, he's like, what's his name? Hey, Brent, you're here. You could correct me. What's the name of the guy, the werebear guy? Bjarki.
Bodvar Bjarki.
Yeah.
Michael Lucero. Bodvar Bjarki.
Yes, yes. I'm trying, and I'm going to butcher it if I try to. Yeah. Bodvar Bjarki. It's straight out of Northern Epic. That's not a fairy tale element at all. You know, again, the guy who turns into a bear and wades into the battle and starts throwing people around. I mean, of course, Bjorn's story ends differently from that. You can tell on account of how he doesn't die, but still, it's again, that's a good example of an element.
So that's still under epic.
Yeah,
still
which sounded almost fairy tale at the beginning, but then shifts midstream to a more epic register. Yeah, and Anthony, I agree. Anthony says that even in The Desolation of Smaug, Bjorn feels more like folklore than fairy tale. That's a really interesting way to characterize that. Certainly, by adding the much more detailed, much more graphically envisioned tragic personal history of Bjorn, you know, it doesn't seem very fairy tale in the film. So, anyway, we have other questions to talk about, and I am being spectacularly bad in my time management today.
I'm really being bad too. I'm no whip cracking over.
No
on this
whip
side.
Crack today. Yeah, yeah. Can we get like a meta whip crack sound that we play when I'm cracking the whip on you to crack the whip more?
Well, oh, that would be cool.
Anyway, because I mean, somebody's got to drive the slave driver, right?
I know, that's right. Especially when the slave driver's shirking.
Exactly. This is bizarrely circular relationship here.
I don't even know. Anyway, what time did we start? Depends. We're only about an hour in, aren't we?
About an hour in. But it means time to move towards the riddle. But before that, we have another crucial question to ask, which is,
what do we think the main characters are going to be doing? So thinking about, you know, leaving aside sort of the themes and characters of the book specifically, given the new situation that has unfolded in the Desolation of Smaug with the presence of Feely, Keely, Beaufort, Owen, and Toriel, at least with the possible addition of Legolas, if he's still within radius of Laketown when the dragon attacks, what role do we see them playing? We talked last time about, do we think they're going to rescue Bard? You know, how are they going to be involved? We tried to sort of hold back on this last time, so now it's time to not hold back. What role do you see them playing? Do you see them achieving anything substantive during the fight? And if so, what? Another question. Even a bigger question, well, not a bigger question, but a weightier question. Do they all survive?
Yeah, that was going to be my question, too. Do we lose anybody? Are there any red shirts among them?
Yeah. Yeah. Does anybody die? I mean, presumably some, like, faceless Laketown people die. Maybe Stephen Colbert dies. I don't know. But do any of the... Because it's conceivable. I mean, like, you know, we could lose... Owen, I doubt we lose Feely or Keely.
Yeah, I think we need to save their deaths for the battlefield, I think.
Yeah.
Owen would be the one of any of them, because I think...
It seems to be the most expendable.
And based on what Boyan said, I guess Beaufort has a bigger role.
Well, I question that. Exactly. First of all, I question all these things. This is one thing about... One thing that I would... And this actually came up in my interview with Robin Reed a couple days ago. She made the excellent point, which I would reiterate and emphasize. Many times, people will send me links to interviews with people like Philippa Boyens or Peter Jackson or one of the actors, and the spirit of the link that I am getting is, here's... the truth behind it. You know, right. This shows what they were really thinking or what they were really planning. Possibly, yes, but the thing you have to keep in mind is those interviews are marketing. Okay, like right. they are strategic. What they reveal and how they reveal it. It's not that I am accusing them of lying, but there may well be fiction involved. You know, they are trying to convey particular things.
Or their choice of words.
Yes, their choice of words. They're trying to accomplish something by giving the interview and by saying what they're saying. You know, I would just be very cautious about. So for instance, there, Philippa Boyan says Beaufort has a significant role. You know, is going to play a really significant role in film 3. A really tragic, emotional death in Laketown could potentially be that really prominent role that he plays in film 3. I'm not saying that I am predicting that, but it's possible that that could happen. Anyway.
I just, you know, I mean, this is one of the things that we talked about last time, I think, you know, when we had to call ourselves off from talking about Smaug, which is, you know, Smaug completely miskilling any dwarves in Erebor. Is he going to do that again in Laketown?
Well, see, it does. It's well established, though it's a fact that many people have disliked, that the spirit of this film, of these films all the way through, have been in... They're like the diametric opposite of Game of Thrones, right? You watch Game of Thrones and you can pretty much count on the fact that any character you like is going to be tortured to death before your eyes probably soon, right?
Yeah, Dave, didn't you say that if you're a good guy, you pretty much die in Game of Thrones? If you're actually good and noble, your death is pretty much assured in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's almost without exception. In The Hobbit, it's like it's the opposite of that, right? Almost nobody, you know, there are almost no occasions on which anyone you like even gets injured, right? I mean, if you are one of the main characters, you know, you can fall 500 feet off a cliff and just brush yourself off when you land at the bottom. The one exception, of course, being Keely's wound,
But that's because it played a dramatic role in the story. You know, he needed to be healed, and so therefore he was permitted to get injured. But it was the, as far as I can tell, the only injury sustained by any of the dwarves in their entire trip so far.
That's right. Well, yeah, and Legolas did get a bloody nose, but...
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right, I did omit Legolas's grievously bloodied nose. That was a very serious moment. however, the point that I'm leading up to there, we're all believing... We've all been confidently speaking of the corpse count that is going to pile up in film 3. You know, we're all like, well, it's a given that Radagast, Toriel, Thorin, Kiwi, and Feely are all dead by the end of the film. Do you realize what whiplash that's going to give people, right? Going from, like, nobody even gets hurt to all of a sudden bodies strewn all over the place? I mean, so one argument, this is all leading up to an argument that says maybe Feely or Kiwi do die in Lake Town. Maybe they want to spread out the mortality. Maybe they don't want to just overload us with, a sea of corpses in the Battle of Five Armies. Maybe we start off early. Maybe we set the tone for the Battle of Five Armies by losing a major character in Lake Town. I could see it. I mean, there's a way in which, like, having so many of those characters die all at once, or, I mean, of course, needless to say, the Battle of Five Armies is going to take a while, so it's not going to be all at once in our experience of viewing the film. But it could be really numbing. I mean, it could have a numbing emotional effect to have so many characters die in the same time and place.
You know, indeed, if we follow sort of the line of logic that initially began with leaving the some of the dwarves in Lake Town, so that we would have some stake in what's going on there, that there would be some characters that we had spent more than 10 minutes of screen time with in danger, as opposed to, you know, some Lake Town people that we kind of just met at the end of the last film. They already made the decision to change things, to leave some dwarves there to kind of move stuff along. Killing one of them would only further that sort of emotional investment of the movie-going audience, right? It's like then the dwarves have felt, then they have experienced some loss as a result of the dragon attack. And that would also maybe serve to heighten the tension between the dwarves that have been left behind in Lake Town and the dwarves in the Lonely Mountain. So not only were they there during the attack and they saw how the Lake Town people suffered, but even maybe one of their own people was injured or killed by Smaug, and that would make sort of Thorin's behavior all the more infuriating to them.
Yes.
And only sort of widen the rift between the two factions of dwarves.
Yeah, I agree. I can't really believe that they would kill off Aidan Turner at the beginning of film 3. But, you know, gosh, I'm tempted. I mean, I can see this. I could see, like, Keeley's death at the beginning of film 3 could work really interestingly. Could be used as a wedge between Feely and Thorin. Could be,
or Feely's death could too. I mean, Feely's death.
But I like Kiwi's even better, because then you've got Toriel in the situation, which is not just like a saccharine, like, oh, but my boyfriend is a dwarf, like I can't. But rather, he's dead already, and she's grieving and upset because, like, she feels like she shouldn't have really loved him anyway, and that was really kind of inappropriate. But she did love him, and now he's dead anyhow. And so now, how is she going to act towards his brother and his uncle, who are both like on different? I mean, it's a really emotionally complex situation for her and the rest of the film if she's not, you know, like, sneaking out for, to, like, make calf eyes at Keeley over the wall, but rather if she's grieving him already. I don't know. I mean, I love it. I don't think it's going to happen, but I think it would be very interesting. But again, I just kind of, I sort of feel like they're going to give,
they're gonna milk Aiden Turner's screen time as much as possible.
I think she's saved his life so many times. I mean, there's gonna be more life saving at the battle, and then one of them will die over the other, and they'll be found with their hands entwined on the battlefield, dead,
buried together.
Yeah. Yeah, and we'll have, what is it, the roses that grow and entwine.
Oh, yeah, love it, love it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Barbara Allen and Sweet William.
Right? Exactly, right, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, or they could have, they could have like a stone statue of a carving of roses above his grave, and live roses from hers, entwining with
right,
him.
So you
got
the
whole dwarf elf thing going on. Oh, man. Man, my only question is, why didn't they hire us? Come on, seriously.
I was thinking the same thing.
Seriously.
They have missed out so much.
Yeah, I'm telling you. It wouldn't have been a better film, but boy, would it have been interesting.
What does Neil say? It wouldn't have been... What does
Nichols
say? Oh no!
Yeah, Nichols says right. It could have been different, but it couldn't have been better.
Better.
Yeah. with us, it's like it wouldn't have been better, but it could have been different. Yeah. Well, anyway, I don't. I want to agree with something that Kim was. Was it Kim? Was saying a little while back. Yes, Kim was Kim Wehrmeister was saying. My question with regard to Bofur or anyone else is: can the movie afford another death, especially in the company? I agree, because as I was saying, I do think all of a sudden, the body count is going to be overwhelming. The idea that they're going to go the Rankin-Bass route again. Remember, in the Rankin-Bass film, they superfluously killed off Glowin and Owen and several others. I mean, they increased the number of dead dwarves, I think, to 7 from 3. And they just reported it off stage. Like, we just came in, Gandalf and Bilbo are talking afterwards, and he's like, oh, by the way, yes, most of the dwarves died. I agree, Kim. It's going to be hard enough to if only the people die who died in the book, it's already going to be hard to take. So adding on to that superfluous extra deaths seems a little bit unlikely. I agree. So even if we go into the working hypothesis that no major characters are going to be killed in Lake Town. As much fun as I think it would be for Kiwi to die, but never mind. That's fine. Well, we can let Kiwi live for another hour or two. What do you see? What do you see them doing? I mean, we had the question of do they rescue Bard or not? Do they play a significant role in the death of the dragon? Is there some, like, do they get an assist in the death of the dragon? Or are they just observers?
Yeah.
Because that's of course possible. They could be primarily involved in trying to help save people. We could get a heroic sequence where, they could be pulling babies out of burning buildings for all we know. It's not like they'd be doing nothing. But, what can they do against the dragon? Are they going to try to distract him? Are we going to get a let's get Smaug's attention to give Bard time to climb the tower sequence? That could happen. That could be really cheesy. I kind of hope that doesn't happen, but it could happen. Or again, could they be in a sense primarily observers? What do you think? What do you guys expect?
I think that if we see anybody assisting Bard, directly with the killing of the dragon, it'll be his son.
Yes, the whole line of Geryon thing.
Right,
yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I could see, I could see there being maybe some aid in distracting the dragon. Hey, dude, over here.
Right.
by the others.
No, it's recapitulate Merry and Pippin at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring.
Right.
Film.
Or what they did in Erebor, right? Hey, you big doofus, I'm over here. Hey,
right, yes, exactly. Me, you know. Exactly.
But I think, you know, I think we'll, if anybody helps Bart, I think it'd be his son directly in terms of killing
Bart. What about sort of preventing the master from interfering?
Hmm. Yeah, if we end up with some kind of a three-way situation, right? Not the town unified against the dragon, but them being an internal struggle. I mean, yeah, they could be fighting off guards who are trying to stop Bard, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, let's come back to that in a minute, because we'll be going in that direction in just a second. One other thing I wanted to mention before we move on to our riddle, which Dave was already indirectly nudging us towards there. The other factor, I just want to reference what James Pace just said, which, James, I completely agree with you. James says, Bard's kids are right there ready to be saved. Absolutely. One of the ways in which the investment of Bard with a backstory, which didn't happen in the book for reasons I explained before, one of the consequences of investing Bard with a backstory is it really changes the dynamics of his saving Lake Town. He can't just do exactly... He's one of the last ones standing. He shoots the dragon and dives into the lake, and the dragon crashes down on the town and destroys the town, and then he emerges alone from the lake, you know, having lost everything else but killed the dragon, and says, and it's a happily ever after moment. Of course, not everybody's happy, but it's a fairy tale moment there when he emerges from the lake. Okay, so I said the thrush was the last fairy tale moment. Maybe it's not, but anyway. The point is, he's a single father with three children now, right? Where are his daughters? Unless we see him pack his daughters off on a boat and he knows they're safe, he's hardly going to be content just to be like, well, I shot the dragon and I got out in time, so job well done. Like, he's got daughters now, right? So, yes, I do think that's going to be a factor. You know, and at the very least, the daughters, again, I expect Bane the son to be involved at the Windlass, to be involved with the shooting of the dragon, at least in some supporting sense. But the daughters, they're going to need rescuing, or maybe they'll do rescuing. You know, maybe they'll get involved in some kind of positive way. Philip suggests that they could always whip up a golden statue, which is a good idea, because it doesn't take long to whip those suckers up, you know. But
yes, and they're immensely mesmerizing.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they really need. It's a good, you know. Yeah, they could just set light to the giant golden dwarf king shaped beacon. So I could easily see this. I think, in my mind, the balance of probability is on the dwarves and Toriel in Lake Town being involved in rescues. You know, that they are running around and they're heroically saving people. They might not even know what Bard is doing. Again, we were talking last time, will they rescue him from prison? It's conceivable they don't even know what's happening, you know, where Bard is and where he's going, but they've got Bard's daughters. You know, when last seen, they were essentially in custody of Bard's daughters while he was off in prison. You know, Bard's daughters are in their zone. And so getting Bard's daughters safely out, you've got to think, if the dragon were to attack now, you know, take where we saw them last, right? Take, you know, this sappy, sentimental moment between Kiwi and Toriel is now suddenly interrupted by the house bursting into flames. You know, they're going to try to get Bard's daughters out alive and presumably try to help, you know, everybody else also. So that's where I think the balance of probability is. But...
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, let's move towards our riddle.
I wonder if the audience will find it. I wonder if people will want them to be involved in the battle with the dragon. But I think it makes a lot more sense if they're, and maybe narratively, if they're running around helping the Lake Town people, it will only increase the degree to which they sympathize with them over Crazy Thorin.
Yes. Yes, and in which there's going to be a more division on the Lake Town side. You know, yep. What we're going to lose, I think, is the sentiment among the people of Lake Town in the book, blaming the dwarves. Right, the way in which the master is able to turn them against the dwarves and blame everything on Thorin and company. Well, if part of Thorin's company is there helping to, you know, pull their biscuits out of the oven when the town is burning, that's going to really change that dynamic. So I think that would be really interesting. But I agree, Dave, I don't think, you know, when we say that they're primarily going to be oriented, to saving people, that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't ever even, like, I can't imagine that Toriel is never going to take even one shot at the dragon with her bow. Like, that's going to happen. You know, there's no way she wouldn't try to shoot it. Nor, when the dragon comes close, do I think that, you know, Feely, Keely, Owen, and Beaufort are going to refrain from trying to fight it. I would expect them to try to fight it, but I don't expect them for that to be their primary focus. You know, I don't think that's going to be the bulk of what they do. So I think that they will be shown to be not cowards. We won't see them scurrying away and running in fear when the dragon comes. But, or at least not only doing that. But again, I don't see them primarily as, you know, focusing on, you know, offense against the dragon. Let's move towards the riddle. So the topic of our riddle today is on the master of Lake Town and what role the master is going to play. As you remember in the book, the master gets into his barge and slips off pretty early on. While Bard is still trying to rally the defense of the town, the master scarpers and receives great criticism for this afterwards, of course. He is accused of being purely self-interested and cowardly in the face of any real threat to the town. And it's one of the things that shifts the politics of the town away from what seems to be, you know, a sort of a financial or guild-based oligarchy, seems to be the governmental system that they have in Lake Town, as far as we see it described in the book, to move away from that back to the traditional monarchy and to have Bard be king. You'll remember the master objects to this change in political philosophy in Lake Town. You know, we in Lake Town have never suffered the rule of mere fighting men. You know, he seems to be concerned that it would be turning the clock back to just revert to crude monarchy in Lake Town. But remember, they're doing this in part because they see the failure of this system. You know, that like when at the end of the day, when a dragon attacks, you really kind of want a king. At least you want a king if the king is going to be like Bard or like Beowulf or somebody. That, you know, you certainly want that kind of king. If the king is going to be like Theoden, you want that kind of king. Those kind of kings are handy in you know, moments of epic and mythical conflict. So, but how are we going to get this in the film? What are we going to see the master doing in Lake Town? I'm gonna go ahead and put the poll options up, so that we can display our choices here. So, option A, book answer, escaping Lake Town. Right. So we will see him. You know, when the dragon attacks, we will see him find a boat, get himself into it, and get the heck out of town. B, cowering somewhere safe in town. So basically, we still see him acting like a coward, but we don't see him necessarily leaving town instantly. I'm losing my options are getting cut off here. You guys can see them better than I can. what does it say? Giving orders while obviously...
Staying clear of danger.
Staying clear of danger, right, okay. Giving orders while obviously still staying clear of danger. So this would be, C would be basically he's sort of fronting. You know, he's not acting courageously. He's not, in fact, bravely standing to as one of the defenders of the town, but he's still acting the part. You know, he's still basically... Mm-hmm. Trying to retain his position as leader of the people, even though he's still looking out for his best interests. He's not going to act self-sacrificially, but he's also not going to just turn tail and run in what would obviously be a sort of politically disastrous move. So that would be C. D, what's the full version of D, Dave?
Basically, he's in the middle of the action.
Right, he's moving active. Around in the middle of the action. Yeah,
he's in there. He's moving around. He's contributing something proactively.
Right. So D would be he's actually involved. You know, he's really. So you can
even
see,
if it's not fighting the dragon, he's helping the dwarves rescue people from burning buildings.
Right. Right. If we see the master of Lake Town pull an old lady out of a burning building, that would be D. You know, he's actually not acting cowardly and shamefully. Sure, he doesn't get a fancy black arrow to shoot at the dragon, but he actually is, you know, but they still have made the choice in the film to transform the Master of Lake Town from a scumbag cowardly figure to someone who is actually acting proactively in the defense or at least in the best interest of the town. And E.
That'll only happen if the thrush talks.
And E is none of the above. And none of the above could include lots of different scenarios that we thought of, but thought were unlikely enough that we would just group them into E. For instance, what were some of the for instances that were. Now I'm going
to.
Oh, blank
we came up with a bunch, didn't we?
I know, we did.
Yeah, I know. This is terrible.
Yeah. Michael Lucero says when the thrush talks should be like the equivalent of Tolkien of saying when pigs fly, or I would add, you know, when the king returns, you know, that's
right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, it could be, you know, E could be he joins forces with Bard. You know, and the two of them together defeat the dragon. I mean, that's like
all of a
totally
sudden, it becomes like a buddy cop film
exactly.
Between the Master of Lake Town and Bard. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, the Master of Lake Town actually pulls the trigger on the shot that kills
right.
the dragon. Yeah, that would
right.
be a staggeringly unlikely E.
That sounds incredible. I love that idea.
You know, that visual image, actually, I'm just, like, picturing, you know, the Master of Lake Town as he was depicted in the second film, standing there like Geryon at the Windlass, saying, you know, shouting his defiance at Smaug. It's a really comical image, that is. Of course, another thing that he could be doing, E would also be, would fit, you know, Dave, the scenario that you were pointing to before. If he is mm-hmm. doing none of these things, if he's neither looking out for his own safety primarily, nor fighting the dragon, but trying to interfere with Bard. I mean, if he, you know,
right.
And the only way that I can see this making any sense is if we are depicting the Master as having gone completely mad, which seems to me not impossible, by the way. I mean, I think we could get, like Denethor, you know, we could get a Denethor-esque Master of Lake Town here, where he ceases to act either in his own best interest or in the best interest of his town, and merely, you know, lapses into his own private obsessions. Conceivably, that could be, him still trying to, you know, arrest or waylay Bard, even if it means, like, preventing him from trying to shoot the dragon. Brian Yoder said, I didn't authorize any dragons in this town. yes. Exactly.
Now, I do want to go back to B and defend B by saying that, you know, cowering somewhere safe in town, I mean, it would be like the master to have created like a subterranean panic room.
Right.
You know, against the odds of the dragon.
A panic submarine. He's got it worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he could have some place that he actually can get to that's, you know, only for him, you know, in the event of emergency. So I could see that, you know, I could see him like in the basement or, you know, in the vaults of his mansion, you know, that he goes down and cowers.
All right. We could also have him, diving into a toilet instead of emerging from it. There would be a kind of a poetic reversal there, which would have, one couldn't exactly call that a mythic power of the bard going, of the master going
escaping
into the toilet. But, I think it could really work in some ways, but no. Here's my B scenario. Do you want to hear my B scenario?
Of course.
Here's my attempt to convert people to B. Okay. The master, when the dragon attacks, is scared completely witless, and so he just like goes tharn completely. He can't do anything. He just is in a complete panic. He doesn't even think to find his boat, and he is rescued by either Toriel or one of the dwarves. So,
oh,
like, they're not pulling babies out of the burning building, they're pulling the master of Lake Town out of the burning building. And this then puts him in a place where he has to, where he probably will eventually stab in the back the people who saved his life during the burning down of the town. But that would be my favorite cowering in fear but not running away sequence.
Actually, I think I'm going to take out the word safe in that sentence.
Okay. Just cowering somewhere in the town.
Cowering somewhere in town, yeah.
Because there wouldn't really be anywhere that would be safe.
Yeah, exactly. That would be safe.
Yeah.
I mean, he may think it's safe, but it's not going to be.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I could see him cowering under his desk like students in a tornado drill or something.
Our old atomic drills.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. I loved those in the 80s. Yes. Yes. In case of nuclear fallout, get under your desk.
Get
because
under
that'll
desk.
Help. Yeah, exactly. even at the time, you know, even when I was in like fifth grade,
even
I was like,
child,
this is really stupid.
Through,
this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Like, you know, I can think of a lot of things I might want to do in the final seconds before the nuclear bomb hits my town. Cowering under my desk is not on the list. You know, I'm sorry. any takers on heroism? You know that we're gonna get a redeeming moment.
C or D would be heroic,
he's been a complete scumbag. But well, so basically, C, in my mind, here's how I translate these. A is irresponsible but pragmatic, right? You know, he keeps his wits enough to get in a boat and leave right away, but does not have enough sense of responsibility to stay and try to do anything or help anybody. B is that he is just he's completely incapacitated by fear, by terror. C is he still retains enough of a sense, like enough belief that the town is going to get through this, that he doesn't want to yield his position. You know, that he's even willing to endanger himself to the extent of staying for the sake of not abandoning, not for altruistic reasons, or not because he's a good person, but because he doesn't want to lose face, because he doesn't want to vacate his authority. And so he continues to posture from his position of authority, even in the middle of a crisis. Basically, this is the idea of him saying, I could take advantage of this crisis and turn it to my personal political advantage. That's the kind of calculation that we would see the master doing.
But he's going to make sure he saves his own skin.
Right, exactly. So he'd still stay clear. You know, again, he wouldn't be acting in any way self-sacrificially, but he would still be acting shrewdly to try to turn it to his advantage. D is
in some sense, an actual change of heart on his part. You know, that where he ceases to be, you know, merely a sort of a puppet ruler, puppet, it seems, in, you know, that Alfred guy's hands, and decides to actually become, in some ways, a sympathetic character. That would be interesting, because, of course, his character is wholly unsympathetic, and I don't think that there's anybody who saw film two that has the slightest shred of investment in the master and what happens to him. In some ways, I thought he was a little bit more of a cipher than I expected. I expected him to be a stronger character in the film than he turned out to be.
Yeah.
He was much more of a nobody. Much more of the, I mean, he didn't even have his own volition, really. It's the way he was manipulated by Alfred was the thing I didn't see coming.
Yeah.
So, here's D. D's his opportunity to grow a backbone.
It'd be interesting to see if they expand him in the extended edition.
There you go. We need another half hour of footage to our now 6 hour long extended edition of The Desolation of Smaug. Absolutely. Yes.
And yeah, by far the missing part was character development for the master.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that is we shall add that to our list of demands for the extended edition of The Desolation of Smaug. Yeah, so again, D certainly would add something. No questions. And, you know, E, man, the world is your oyster. You know, you can do anything. Heck, you know, E would be like, he runs off to report to his orc overlords that the plan has failed and all is in ruins. Or he goes to report to his orc overlords that everything is working according to plan and Smaug is attacked just like he was supposed to. Could happen.
Maybe he's in league with Smaug all along. Ah, oh, bet you didn't see that coming. Okay.
Yeah, I like the idea of him fleeing to Mordor.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so no, it turns out that he and Smaug are allies secretly. And this is revealed to the viewers during the battle sequence. Yep. Yep. There we go. I feel like I've pretty much solved it, so yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. Which one are you choosing, Corey?
Oh, I'm not going to choose that. I'm just predicting it. I'm just going to. I was hoping to be sufficiently confident to induce at least one person to guess E, but I'm totally failing.
Should we open the poll before we give our answers?
Oh, I did open the poll.
Oh, you did open the poll.
Yeah,
oh.
I opened the poll. I opened the poll so they could see the options in front of them on their screens
while
we talked about it.
Okay, we got it. Okay, there we go.
Okay, there we go. I got an E. Thank you, sir. Okay, I don't know who did it, but that was awesome. You made my day there.
C&D, definitely. Doesn't matter that you were able to come up with things. You just can't sell C or D.
No, I can't sell C&D at a discount, apparently. Okay.
Oh, you got another...
Well, see, E is... There's so much breadth available to E.
I know, that's true. You don't have to actually commit yourself to much with E, you know.
Yeah.
But you do have to commit yourself to... It's not he runs away or hides.
Right.
Which is... Abandoning those is pretty... It's pretty tough.
Yeah, does he even have enough spine for C? Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things about C is I could see him giving orders to Alfred. And Sharon points out, you know, is his giving his orders like, is he telling Alfred to pack his stuff up? Is that giving orders? You know, I mean, I think the spirit of the thing is more giving orders with regard to the attack.
Yes, exactly. That he positions himself in a way so that he could say... You know, I led the defense of the town.
Right, right.
Later on, again, he's fronting. He's fronting as he's not going to act self-sacrificially. He's not going to be a true, leader. He's not Theoden riding in the forefront of the host, you know, charging ahead of the Rohirrim into, you know, solo into the Battle of Pelennor Field. He's not going to be Theoden, you know. But could he at least be, as I say, trying to work it, trying to maintain his position of authority? In the end, no, I can't see him having even that much spine. He just seems like such a wuss. And as much as I like the idea of having him, you know, grow in a new direction and become more interesting, I don't think so. I'm going to go with B. I think I talked myself into B.
That he's going to stay in town.
But he's going to stay in town, and what's more, I will add as a free bonus prediction, he will stay in town, and he will be rescued from death by one of the other characters. By either one of the dwarves, or by Toriel, or by one of Bard's daughters, or somebody. Probably not by Stephen Colbert, but somebody
else. Right. The dramatic irony that we would get out of Bard's daughters rescuing the master would be just rich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you could have, you know, them later on, like you know, bringing in like a soot stained, bedraggled master and being all like, you know, we found him. Can we keep him? You know, that, you know, yeah. Both the comic and dramatic potential of this are real good. And as I said, what I love most, the thing that I said that most convinced me to go with B, the thing that made the idea that made me fall in love with B is this idea of setting up a double cross from him later on. You know, that basically, because one of the things that we're seeing, one of the major dynamics that has already come into play that we've referred to so many times, is the way in which the alliances and the personal allegiances in the lead up to the Siege of the Lonely Mountain have been so much more complicated in the film. And to have another one of those, which then turns out to be betrayed, you know, to have the dwarves think they have an ally in the master, and then to have him stab them in the back, presumably by making some kind of horrible deal with Thranduil or something like that. Because remember, we do have that reference in the book to the fact that the master was willing to agree to almost any, you know, agreement to get the help of the Elven King. I could see that detail floating to the surface in the film. And the master cutting some kind of deal with Thranduil. And maybe, you know, that's the thing that he does that, you know, ends up, like, stabbing people in the back. So, anyhow.
I've been kind of trying to decide between A and B. I think I'm going to go with B because I don't think the escape from Lake Town... First of all, I don't think it's going to be an escape from Lake Town. I think he will leave Lake Town. I think he will be banished from Lake Town. And I think it'll happen after the dragon's dead and Bard has taken over. So I think B is what's going to happen. I think he'll stay in town and just be a complete coward.
So he's going to stay in town, and he's not going to run away, but he'll be like bundled into a boat with a bunch of other refugees. And
well, I think he'll end up being banished after it, right, fairly dramatically. Yeah,
but of course, banishment could follow from either A or B. I mean, banishment almost follows from A in the book.
Right, it does almost.
Well, actually, but I think, you know, actually, during there are implications that attack. Lynching almost follows from A.
That's
in the
true.
Book.
But I mean, that's even after the dragon's dead. And since we're talking now about during Smaug's attack, I think he'll stay in town and just be a complete blubbering mess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Brianna asks a good question. Escaping but failing to escape still counts as A. Yes, it does, Brianna. I would say if he you know, tries to get away in a boat but is not successful, I would still count that as A.
That still would
what
be
about, yeah. What about escaping and then being burned alive?
Gosh, that's either A or E, huh?
Tom was suggesting that. Tom Hillman was imagining the master of Lake Town in a boat frantically rowing away out of town, and then Smaug falling from the sky right on top of him and his boat
you know, like the big chunks of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man coming down on people, you know, at the end
of
Ghostbusters.
Jackson's alternate Middle Earth, that could happen.
It's conceivable. I can think of very few suggestions about film 3 that I am more hoping don't happen than that so far. That might be the suggestion I would least like to see actually occur. It would be funny, but that's exactly why I would hate it. That there would be a moment of comic relief in the middle of that scene would be horrible, I think.
No, yeah. I can't see that.
Bridget?
So, Dave.
B.
You're going with B also?
Yeah, this is an easy one where I for once agree with Corey. I think it's going to have to be I really like the idea of him being rescued by Bard's daughters.
that would be awesome.
That would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
Now, interestingly enough, we have 68% voted, but it's been up for almost 22 minutes now, so I'm thinking we can share the results from the poll.
Yeah, let's do that.
Interestingly enough, A has been the answer that won.
Yep, A has been the dominant answer. And, you know, I can easily see that. I mean,
me too.
I think the book answer might be more probable for this one than any other riddle we've done this season so far. I can definitely see it. I can definitely see it. But, like Dave, I'm going to hold out for Bard's daughters. I think that would be awesome.
Well, and I guess you did have a good point, which is he really didn't get developed that. He had much... A very sort of his role in the Desolation of Smaug was much less than we expected.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, I feel like having him flee the town takes him out of the on-screen mm-hmm. action in the story. Whereas having him remain in town and maybe be rescued or interfering or just something like that keeps him in the story, keeps him involved, mm-hmm. keeps mm-hmm. him on screen. And it just makes more sense to me that he would continue to be involved. As opposed to having to flash back and forth between here's Bard and the dwarves trying to save the town, here's the master on a boat heading out of town, here's dwarves and Bard, then back to the master and Alfred again. If he's actually there, if he's hiding or something, then it's much easier to integrate him in without having to go back and forth.
Right. Good. Well, we should let people go as mm-hmm. we have come to the end of our time, past the end of our time here.
And next time I'm going to turn on my timer.
Yeah. We do have a couple announcements that we wanted to end with. The first thing we wanted to announce is we have some firm Mythmoot news to announce Yay! To everybody. We have definitely firmed up our venue and our dates. So you can now make definite travel arrangements. You can circle things in your calendar way in advance. You'll notice how far ahead of the game we are this year in getting things together. So first of all, I would tell you the dates are the weekend of January 10th and 11th, 2015. That is the official date of Mythmoot for this year. And we will be at the BWI Marriott in Baltimore. So we'll be back in Baltimore again. In fact, we'll be back at the venue where we were for Mythmoot 1, for those of you who attended there. It's the same hotel that we were in the first time. So that's the place. That is the date. That's what's going to happen.
Registration will be opening up sometime later this month, we assume.
Soon, yes.
Right? Early bird pricing.
Yes, that's the other thing. We're going to be doing one thing as a consequence of being prepared earlier. We are going to have early bird registration, so you will be able to get a ticket at a discounted rate if you sign up early. And I believe we're defining early as anything before September. Isn't that what we were saying?
Yeah, I think we were talking about August, end of August being
the cutoff.
Yeah, the
end of August being the cutoff. So Yeah.
Probably around the same time that the riddles.
The riddles, yeah. I was thinking the same thing. As long as we're still answering riddles, you can get the early bird
rate. That's right. I think we should do that. That's the one hook that we'll have to Riddles in the Dark is.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's going to be, I'm really excited to have things open. Now, there are still some things, of course, that we have not yet finished determining. One of the primary things is, you know, we're still working on a couple different options for some special guests that we're hoping will join us. And I can't give you more information on that yet because we haven't set anything in stone there. But we definitely have some fun options under consideration, and we're hoping for some pretty cool things. So we'll definitely keep you posted with more news on that front as we go, but we do, so you know, we will be opening it for registration. We will be doing papers again, so those of you who might be interested to present papers, which I strongly encourage you to submit proposals. We had such a great pool of papers last year, so we very much look forward to that. We will be sending out our official call for papers soon also. So that's another thing that you can be anticipating.
And we actually, this year, will have a hospitality suite, which means we could actually be doing the very cool Scrabble tournament.
Exactly. Yes, we will have a separate...
Yeah.
We will have some different configurations of space at the conference. So we will have a hospitality suite.
The Knoffeltoffel tournament.
Exactly. We could do that thing. That is something that could be done by us at MythMoot. Absolutely. we could play the full Norse version, you know, where the good guys all die at the end. Are surrounded and you go down with Odin. Anyway, so yeah, we will do that. We can do all of these things and more at MythMoot this year. So be watching in the next few weeks. Probably by our next episode, we will be able to. That's my goal. We might be able to open registration by then. Certainly, we'll be able to explain things like ticket prices and everything a little bit more clearly next time. But we are making very concrete progress towards having things all set for MythMoot here. So we're very much looking forward to that. Okay. Other announcements that I'm forgetting, Trish?
Did you want to talk about the Mythgard Academy? We started.
Oh yes, we did start. Courses. We just started the new Mythgard Academy class. We did our first class on Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card on Tuesday. That was a lot of fun. The course is going to be six sessions long, and we did session number one. I've basically scheduled to talk about the book in the first four sessions, and then with a fifth session for Q&A, and then a sixth session to discuss the film adaptation of Ender's Game. For those of you who know me, what that really means is I will probably take five sessions talking about the book, because the odds I'm going to get through the entire book at the end of the fourth session, I think, are relatively small, especially since that last section is really long. So anyway, but it should be fun. We talked about the first six chapters on this past Tuesday, and that was really neat. I've been noticing so much that I never saw before. I always really enjoyed this book, but I've been admiring it a great deal more, even as I've been looking at it really closely and working through it. So that's been really great. So if you are interested in that, please do join us there. We should be having soon elections for our next book. We need to start putting that into place. Because this class will be ended in the middle of May, so it'll be time soon to start thinking about what will follow Ender's Game as well. And of course, Tolkien will be back on the ballot potentially for next time. So we'll see. Good.
And summer courses, right?
Yeah, the summer courses. And as I mentioned last time, we talked about them some last time, so I won't discuss them a whole lot right now. But just to remind you, registration is open for Mythgard's summer courses. The in-depth study of the Harry Potter series with Amy Sturgis, the first ever Harry Potter professor on the planet. She's doing her awesome Harry Potter class again this summer. I am teaching the Canterbury Tales, so if ever you have come to
if ever you've wanted to really understand why Chaucer is awesome, and you have been afflicted by, you know, a weak and lame exposure to Chaucer in a high school English class or something like that, I encourage you to come and discover how much fun Chaucer really is with me this summer. And then our third class is a really neat class. It's the one I was alluding to earlier on, Robin Reed's class on The Lord of the Rings from a cultural studies and audience response point of view. So if you have ever wanted to really know more about what kind of impact did The Lord of the Rings have, and not only in America and England, but around the world, how what kind of impact did The Lord of the Rings have on Russian culture? What kind of impact did The Lord of the Rings have on Italian culture in the mid to late 20th century? Questions like that, as well as looking at things. How was Tolkien's depiction of elves, for instance, really interacting with and reflecting the fairy tradition of his time? It's something that I've talked around at various points, but she's going to really be looking at in a lot of detail. So just really fascinating stuff. If ever you've been sort of thinking, wanting to know more about how Tolkien really fits in the 20th century, both his influence and his impact, it should be a really great class. So that's Professor Robin Reed's course on The Lord of the Rings from a cultural studies and audience reception approach. So, and I think that finalizes our announcements. Thanks for your patience in sticking with us during an old school, long length Riddles in the Dark episode, for which I repent, and which we'll try to do better
and
next time.
I will be flogged with spaghetti after the show.
Yeah, we'll be back to making bricks without straw next time.
We will make corrections for this.
Exactly. But in any case, as usual, and even more enthusiastically than customarily, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.